Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to On Point. I'm Don Allen with my co-host in Studio A, Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Good evening, Mr. Edwards. How are you?
Good afternoon and evening, Mr.
Yeah.
Allen. Good to be with you on this kind of sultry, humid day here in the Twin Cities once again.
Yes.
I understand we have a number of items. I understand we have a big First Amendment battle that has been joined under the auspices of Major Louis King and others of the powerful Relief Tornado Committee. But first, I just want to touch on the international peace. Of course, it's been on the screens across the world. A tragic day yesterday in Norway, a place which you normally would not think would be the target of terroristic attacks. But it appears that a single Norwegian citizen, acting alone, though I doubt it very much, was involved in a dual act of terrorism, the bombing of government offices in central Oslo, the capital of Norway. They say 8 or 9 are dead there, though I have a feeling there may be more. Bomb went off right in front of the offices of Norway's prime minister. But the greatest amount of carnage was carried out in just a single act, if you will. In fact, we're watching some of it, massacre in Norway, on monitors here in the studios. It appears that this Norwegian citizen, dressed as a Norwegian policeman carrying automatic weapons, has killed at least 82 or 83 individuals, primarily young people, on that island, shooting and killing some of them while they were in the water as they desperately tried to swim away from the island. The island is a small island. It has been a place where there's been what is called a youth camp. Scandinavian countries have been big for decades on youth camps and activities. This gunman, by the way, was able to kill with immunity, if you will, for over an hour and a half before Norwegian police and security forces were able to storm the island. He is in custody, and so it's going to be interesting. He has been identified as a right-wing extremist. Now, early yesterday, with the traditional poor journalism here in the United States and the European countries, they were saying that it was a Muslim terrorist attack, and everybody was gearing up. And then because the individual was captured, his picture was immediately flashed across the world, and you could see looking at him right now as we talk, blue-eyed, blonde-haired, Caucasian, Norwegian, if you will, the whole demeanor and discussion, Mr. Allen, has changed with respect to what was going on. The man has also been identified by the head of Norwegian National Security as a Freemason. He was a farmer. I think there's probably a whole lot more that they'll be talking about, but this was a horrendous act of terror, if you will. And it'll be interesting to see how the experts deal with that. But at least now 92 dead, 83 or 84 of those in one single act on a very small island, if you will, as people were gunned down, sought out, stalked, and then killed. So bad situation.
Yes, I would say so.
All right, so what do we got, Don?
Well, we got a pretty interesting set of circumstances, Mr. Edwards. As you know, on Wednesday of this week, the North Side, the tornado response team meeting, it was demanded that local bloggers and news agencies take down pictures, videos, and likenesses of anybody that stood at the table of the North Side community response team. And, the Minneapolis Mirror, Terry Izaguirre, editor-in-chief over there, had shot some pretty damning video of Mr. King talking to a tornado victim. And we spoke about that on last week's show also. And a document was set out by the Transparency and Accountability Committee's Lisa Jones that said, we must take down these videos and the likenesses.
Now, the only two people that had videos up on your respective websites were How does she pronounce her name again? Terry what?
Izaguirre. Terry Izaguirre.
Izaguirre. Because my understanding is I sat in that meeting. I was there with Mr. Allen as Major King, actually. I identify him as Major Louis King, United States Army, Artillery, Domestic Intelligence. But Mr. King also indicated that if you failed to comply, that you would be forcibly removed from OIC. Is that correct?
Yes. If you failed to
remember
reply,
that?
You, yes. Oh, yes. I was sitting there in the meeting, and also he also threatened legal action against anyone who did not comply. And
he identified the very powerful, powerful law firm of Dorsey & Whitney, one of the largest in the United States, who he says is both his organizational and personal attorneys. And he, in fact, he gave the two of you, because you could have been, even though there were all kinds of other journalists in the room, such as myself, Charles Hallman of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the oldest black newspaper in the state, and then Jones, a man by the name of Alfred Flowers. Mel Reeves was also present there. But it was specifically you and Terry, as you referred to, the Minneapolis mayor, who were specifically told that you had 24 hours. Don, I'm trying to understand the legal precedent for Major King making that declaration. Of course, we were in
yes.
his castle, in his concentration camp, if you will. I mean, he can say whatever he wants. But he ordered you and the Minneapolis mayor to cease and desist and to take down the information within 24 hours. Did you folks comply?
We did. The videos were not taken down from YouTube. The videos remain on YouTube. And
videos also remained on the Minneapolis mayor's personal website, as I understand.
Yes. Yes.
Okay,
Mrs. Aguirre did not.
So you did not comply. Have you now been served on Saturday? Have you been served with an official document to cease and desist by Major King and his powerful law firm of Dorsey Whitney?
Well, you know, I'm not going to always run to the mailbox, but no. You know, I mean,
I don't
wait for checks in the mail, Mr. Edwards, or anybody knock on my door and serve me any papers. But no.
Okay.
And it's very interesting that that these turn of events and what the request was, because it was out of line and thwarted the freedom of the press and the issues that surround the freedom of the press. I do know that that people were contacting Ms. Terry.
You're kind of breaking up there a little bit. Contacting attorneys, because like we had a glitch there.
Okay.
People are contacting attorneys or?
No, what happened was that people had been contacting Ms. Izaguirre, like Reporters Without Boundaries. And Freedom House and Committee to Protect Journalists, the ACLU. And a couple of other really powerful federal lawyers here in town that we both actually consulted with, who basically told us that they, from that point when we got the memo, that, yeah, okay, we're going into this building and they don't want us to tape, so we have to honor that. But anything prior to that is...
retroactive, in other words.
Yeah. Yeah, it's free range, free market. It's out there. It's covered by the first. Now, whether or not someone, you know, Mr. Edwards, likes what they got caught saying on video, that's irrelevant, because if that was the case, that somebody in power or someone affluent can demand that videos be taken down off YouTube and pictures be taken out of newspapers, then, you know, you have to look at the number of celebrities that have been caught in questionable circumstances with videos from Pam Anderson to Paris Hilton, you know, that basically could do nothing because
Allen, I have to indicate this because it is my understanding that on yesterday you were directed by the woman identified as Miss Lisa Jones. you were directed by her to also cease and desist and to remove all video materials that dealt with the controversial tobacco issue that you were so much in the forefront of exposing. Now, what was her legal justification and precedent, is actually the proper word that I would use. What was her legal precedent operating under the power of the tornado relief team? And have you complied with her orders and directives given to you sometime, I understand, early yesterday morning?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not understanding how people feel they can do that. And she herself is a journalist.
Yes, and by no means will I comply with that because, again, at the time, she can or would or is considered a public figure. She's also a journalist. She broadcasts on a local radio station here and writes a column for a local paper here.
Let me just say this because I think it's important because, you know, this program, and we certainly need to give the number. Because is she also a grants writer for KAMLJ? Is she a grants writer? Didn't she write a grant for monies from the Minneapolis Foundation, according to documentation?
Yes. There was a lot of people at the table who did their own or sailed their own ship as far as submitting proposals to the Minneapolis Foundation.
So we didn't go out as the great battle fleet that Major King insisted and pretended that they were, so there were individual flotillas?
Yes, there were. And part of this is what I call, you know, trying to ride someone's jock. Just because Mr. King said, you know, take down his likenesses and his videos does not mean that you fall into that same category. Because number one, in this case, Lisa Jones has been influenced. She is less than authoritative, and she holds no credence. And so, what comes out of her mouth basically is folly, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, and let me also, purpose of absolute factual information and declaration here. My understanding is that about at 7 or 8 minutes to two, maybe even 10 minutes to two on Wednesday. Terry Vassaglieri, or however you pronounce the name, seen her. I've never really met her. I understand as she was setting up her equipment, Major King and others approached her and directed her out of the door and told her that she had to remove her equipment. Is that correct? Because, see, I was not there. I did not arrive until approximately 1 minute after two and took my position at the back table where we have been directed basically to set. So were you present when they confiscated or, you know, forced her to exit the building with her electronic equipment?
Yeah, I actually saw them, Mr. King, tell her that she could not tape at the event. And so she did step outside, but she did not
leave. She complied.
She complied. Totally complied, but did not leave the facility. But, you know, was very
why was it necessary for Major King to go to a great level of elaboration indicating that failure to comply with his directives would necessitate, and I assume maybe even armed force to be used to remove any person who did not comply? Were we at that kind of stage there? Did you or Terry said anything to indicate that you did not intend to comply?
Well, no, I don't think that was the case at all. I just, you know, I found it slightly unusual and strange to have a request like that because, you know, videotape does not lie. So what you said and the tapes that were put up were unedited.
And
so, if you are saying something that is against the grain, or if you are talking to a victim of a tornado who is poor, homeless, and is requesting, you know, asking where the money went, and you are rejecting that question and has folly, then that's on tape. You know, the tape didn't lie. The But then again, you know, Mr. Edwards, this is one of the many things that happens in our black, in the black community, or in the community in North Minneapolis, when we ask what happened to the money. You know,
yeah,
we are,
and Mr. King and a man named Flowers and others have said to those of us in the group who make the mistake of asking about accounting for the money, we have been told, and I understand that the Minneapolis Mirror, in fact, has captured that on video also. I know that they were taping as the statement was being made in our presence, that we're not here about the money. We're not concerned about the money. Whatever happens to the money is okay, kind of thing. And so if there's mismanagement of the money, it's nobody's business. Now, Don, I have to ask you this particular question, because during the course of the declarations by Mr. King about the censorship and the control of information and actions against some segments of the media, the high-ranking representative of the Minneapolis Foundation, who has just given this organization over $1 million, you know, I would have thought normally under the policies and the bylaws of the Minneapolis Foundation that she would have absented herself and left the room as it pertains to a responsibility. But I noticed that she sat there. I know she was sitting behind me, and she seemed to be very comfortable. And as I said last week, I received a electronic message from her, if you will, and what she told me as a journalist, raising questions about some aspects of funding and non-accountability. She told me that the Minneapolis Foundation wasn't concerned with what happened to the money after they gave them to them. And that kind of bothers me because, you know, people may buy weapons or explosives or dope or so. I mean, is this a pattern that we can expect from the foundations in the future? What's your thinking on that?
Well, I think that the Minneapolis Foundation has given the money to this group, okay? And I think that the Minneapolis Foundation, in my eyes, have held them to a strict set of goals. And
okay.
But there are those factions within the tornado relief group that, you know, in some cases have not ran a shoeshine shop, and that have ran or other organizations to the tune of $10-20 million into the ground, and who are now at the table under the auspices of human need. So
But Major King has now set a historical legal precedent as it pertains to an attack and assault upon the First Amendment, and he has indicated he will dictate how the First Amendment is applied and how it is interpreted. And he is indicating that one of the largest law firms in the United States of America, Dorsey Whitney, concurs, and one of the more prosperous and larger foundations in the state of Minnesota, the Minneapolis Foundation, apparently not only concurred and certainly gave its tacit approval, because everyone in that room knew that the representative of the Minneapolis Mirror was the target, if you will, of the First Amendment violations. And I guess I'm a little frightened and concerned that the next step will be to basically tell those of us who are more of the written media and Fourth Estate that we will not be able to even write about what goes on in the committee unless it is pre-approved by the so-called Transparency Committee and et cetera. Is that your sense of where we're basically at right now?
Yeah, we're kind of in the communist China mode, Mr. Edwards, that I'd like to think. And, I mean, no one will control, you know, what I write or what I say and what anybody else writes or say. But it's interesting that, you know, they want to take it to that extent. And it's really a sad commentary because, again, it's trying to control, you know, what gets out. And again,
they are controlling. But go ahead. I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry I cut you off. But they are controlling. But go ahead.
Yeah, but the question still remains, where is the money going? And there's also a political angle that we have to look at here. We have strong liberal leadership here that has denied a group of poor people, our victims in this case, some financial recourse. And we even sat in a meeting on Wednesday, Mr. Everton, and the woman talked about, there was a lady there that talked about she applied for the Small Business Administration assistance, for, and I'm still talking along the lines of freedom of speech and things like that. And she was kind of abruptly stopped, shut down, and there was no follow-up or no suggestion for what her circumstances were.
And let's be even a little bit more clear, transparent. The woman in question, an African-American resident who lived on Penn Avenue North in the tornado disaster area, talked in terms of how she was told and encouraged some of that information coming out of the committee in which you and I have been present and observers at. And her question, specific question to the head of the powerful Pillsbury United organization, Shonda Smith-Baker, was because Shonda was giving out all these numbers, success numbers, you know, how many applications were taken, blah, blah. And this African-American woman raised the following question. Her question was, how many applications have been rejected? And she had her letter of rejection in her hand. And that's what my colleague, Mr. Allen, is pointing out, that she articulated for about 4 minutes. Of course, in that all electronic device except for a camera on the back wall, which Major King said hadn't operated since the 1970s. That's not true. That kind of camera wasn't made in the 1970s. But what I'm getting ready to say, of course, will be contested by the major and his core group, if you will, command staff, because when she talked about what had happened, she being the African-American resident living on Penn Avenue, and she talked about the letter of rejection, and she talked about other things she had seen at Lucy Laney School and et cetera. You're absolutely correct, Mr. Allen. There was no response to her. No one jumped up and said, we will look into this immediately. Major King did not indicate, as he had indicated he had done on behalf of Shonda Smith-Baker, where he had sent a letter directly on her behalf under the name of the organization after she was cited for problems with her home, and she maintains her home was damaged during the tornado. And I remember well the previous two meetings, Major King, in fact, asking for applause, in fact, indicated that he had sent this scathing letter to the mayor and other important city officials indicating and demanding that Shonda Smith-Baker, a member of the core committee, how dare them, the audacity, in fact, he used the word audacity, treat her like that. Now, when this African-American woman, just a civilian, if you will, stood up and talked in terms of being denied SBA monies and et cetera, not a single voice was uttered by core committee individuals, nor Ms. Smith-Baker, who at that point was standing, still giving her report. And so just for transparency, if you will, this is one of the things my colleague, Mr. Allen, is citing. And, you know, I sat and I looked. I was, in fact, sitting just across within probably 4 feet of this African-American woman. And if someone wants to ask the question, well, why didn't you get up and say something? The fact of the matter is Mr. King, Major King, has basically indicated that Mr. Allen and myself were basically limited to maybe no more than one or two questions per meeting. If it goes beyond that, then we have serious confrontations. And like I said, I'm aware that Major King has a permit, as I understand it, to conceal and carry. And so, you know, after I had heard him earlier indicate that he would use whatever necessary force to remove you if he became disenchanted or dissatisfied with you, you know, I'm not looking to be gunned down, in the hallway or outside of OIC. I mean, I have to be very clear to you on that.
Yeah. I agree 100%. And part of this is, Mr. Edwards, getting back to that original question, that question that is feared by all 200 nonprofits.
Yeah, where's the money?
Where's the money? Show me the flow. And even the Pillsbury United Communities with Shonda Smith Baker. You have to look at her and you have to say that this is great. You're giving out numbers of how many were filled out, how many were approved, how many were accepted, how many were denied. Okay, that's static nonprofit folly. Okay, the important thing is how are the people, the victims in the street? That paperwork means absolutely nothing. So how are the people in the streets doing? You know, and it's not good. I did a video myself, Mr. Edwards, actually on last Sunday. I drove up and down Sheridan, Upton, and a couple other streets were just, tree stumps were just torn out of the ground. There's trees still on houses.
Yeah, still there.
Yeah, it looks like it happened yesterday. And so I hopped out of the truck and I was talking to this lady who wasn't sure who I was. And so what I did was I gave her the address to my website. I said, I'm home and I'm going to post this video, right? As soon as I post the video and she saw it on YouTube, and she found out, she went to my website and she found out my telephone number and she called me. She goes, my husband and I would like to talk to you. And I had a question for her because originally when I jumped out of the truck, I mean, she didn't know me back then. She didn't know me from Adam or whoever. And so I was asking her, why is this huge tree stump still in front of your house? And why is this tree all still on top of this other house? And lo and behold, her sister had lived in the house that still today has a tree on it. Okay, she's since moved, but people in the city of Minneapolis are telling her that the U.S. Forestry Service has to get involved, and that was the first I ever heard of that. I said, "What,
Ms. Allen? That's just the furthest thing from the truth. I mean, you're absolutely correct. I was on the scene within about an hour and a half to 2 hours after the tornado on the afternoon of the 22nd." I saw private companies. I did not see the U.S. Forestry Service anywhere to be seen. I saw private contractors at 6 and 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 22nd of May, with workforces cutting up trees and et cetera, trees on houses, trees pulled up by the roots on sidewalks, across cars, and et cetera. I've never heard that before. That's absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, well, this is what's being told to them. Are these citizens that those tree stumps are not going to be removed from outside of your houses, even though they're on city property, on the boulevard, on the sidewalk, until the U.S. Forestry Service comes in and removes them. And I found that very hard to believe. Plus, Mr. Edward, I've been saving this little thing. I call it my sweetheart. I actually called the Pillsbury United resource line, that phone number they've been putting out everywhere. That's on the Minneapolis Foundation website.
Right.
You hear it on KMLJ, but, you know, you can't Google it anywhere. So it's worthless as far as I'm concerned. But I called it, and I told the woman that I pretended I was a tornado victim. I said, this is a very important part of research. And I said, hey, you know, a tree fell on my house. My refrigerator is not working. It hasn't worked since the tornado. The stucco on my house is cracked. And, you know, Minnesota, they have a no-patch law, which means you have to do everything. You have to do the roof, the stucco, everything, all over again, the whole thing. And I told her, I said, my insurance company came out, and they only want to give me $6,000. And it's going to cost $12,000. And I don't know. Especially about my refrigerator. What should I do? And the person that answered the phone said I needed to dial 311, which totally defeats the purpose of what that number is there to set up to be.
Yeah, you're correct. Well,
yeah.
Let me. I've just returned from a discussion, and in fact, because of the level of retaliation and et cetera. By the city and endorsed by the recovery committee. But I just had a chance to meet with and talk with some residents along the 2100 block of one of the streets. And what happened was a African-American homeowner provided me with a copy. You know, the guy known as Chad, who is in charge of housing, which means that, you know, taking and put a white guy in charge of land, he who owns the land controls the political agenda. But what's happened, and I'm holding here in the studio waving it at you, I'm holding a two-page letter from a city inspector issued on the 27th day of June. And the inspector's name, in fact, I'm going to give his name, and I'm sure he can take these calls. His name is Ryan. Last name is, the phone number is 612-369-7026. He wrote a very ugly letter to this African-American homeowner who lives on, and I'll give the street, but I'm not going to identify the person, because I've found that basically every African-American family on this street has received notices of impending condemnation based on nuisance, and there's something to the nuisance. It's the 2100 block of Russell Avenue North in the city of Minneapolis. And one of the things that I had been told over the last number of weeks, and finally was able to get the necessary empirical data, that one of the ordinance violations that the city has been invoking is nuisance. Mm-hmm. You have to understand, this is a tornado. These folks do not have prior citations and et cetera. But what he said in the letter, he reminded this African-American homeowner that if you receive two of these within a year, there will be specific action of condemnation and et cetera against your property. And by the way, she was due to correct everything by the 14th of July. Now, here's what they did to her. Remember when we had the great volunteer undertaking in which African-Americans were really not allowed to participate? You remember that, Don, about a month ago?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Her backyard, by right of almost eminent domain, was used as a dumping place. Mm. And so all kinds of stuff that was being, let's say, gathered up there in the vicinity of Thomas and Russell and Queen and et cetera, where her yard was one of many yards in houses occupied by African Americans that these white volunteers were told to dump the refuse, right?
Yes.
And so the refuse was dumped in her yard. In fact, in the document, again, it indicates furniture, mattresses, scrap wood, and et cetera. But this inspector, Ryan, invoked the nuisance provision. And the other piece that he says to her at page 2, and at this point we'll certainly give the number, they have in this form letter, this is a very, you know, interesting letter, housing does not typically grant extensions for nuisance violations. Now, isn't that interesting?
Yep.
So if you talk in terms of the circumstances that have caused all this stuff to be in your backyard that was dumped there by volunteers allegedly brought in. When I say the alleged part is volunteers, because our understanding is that many of these white folks were paid. But because they cite you for a nuisance violation, you really have no right of appeal.
No.
Now, when some of these questions were raised by yourself and I in the meetings of the powerful committee a month and a half ago, we were hearing that. We were hearing the whole thing about black folk who were being evicted because their white landlords didn't have rental license. Major Louis King, United States Army, artillery/domestic intelligence, said we were not here to discuss that, right? But yet he took time out from his busy schedule to send a scathing letter demanding that a member of the core group who's probably making $95,000 a year, be given special consideration because a citation had been left on her home. Now, Kenneth, can you make me understand the preferential difference here?
Well, that might be called, you know, taking care of the people close to camp, but this is what has gone on, Mr. Edwards, as you well know, for over 50 years. I mean, there are...
Yep.
There is no recourse for someone that is not in the loop. So if Lissa Jones, Al Flowers, Chandra Smith Baker, Reverend Coleman, Fred English, Bill English, and those folks all had houses damaged in the tornado, they would actually get preferential treatment. through this whole process. Okay. It's a dirty, rotten shame, but, you know, again, the needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many.
So when Major Louis King, United States Army, told an African-American woman a couple of weeks ago, which was captured by the Twin City Mirror, or the Minneapolis Mirror, which led to their legal representative having her First Amendment rights shut down. When Louis King said, you know, I mean, he almost said to her, "Mammy, we're not here to put money in your pockets." Is that what that meant?
I would have to suspect so, because no money is going in any of the pockets of the people that actually need it. And it's really unusual because we have to realize, Mr. Edwards, we're sitting at that table as a group or a committee void of anybody that's really in those neighborhoods. These people in the neighborhoods, I found out, they have no clue what's being done on their behalf.
No, because the neighborhood clubs are actually, by and large, controlled by white citizens, and I think we've seen that. And so for years there's been complaints, be it Willard Homewood or McKinley, or where black folk who were there long before the white folks returned, if you will, who have been complaining about the fact with respect to the neighborhood organizations that they are not made known, they are not cognizant of meetings, political format, and et cetera. And by the way, just so that our listening audience, domestic, international, is clear, the city just kicked in, what was it, $2 million more for so-called infrastructure cleanup?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And the city just received that on Friday, and what that's done is that a large group of white contractors who are really not licensed to do business have already been rolled in. By the way, how did the jobs thing, how did the jobs thing through the Urban League and the Public Works Department, how is that working out, Don? Have you been able, do we have the full 150 young men working through the Minneapolis Department of Public Works? How's that going?
Well, notice, Mr. Edwards, at the last meeting on Wednesday that Scott Gray was not in the building. Okay.
Oh, and Scott Gray. You know why? I realize Scott Gray had a board meeting that night because the Urban League is getting ready to knock off at least 25% of the 12 employees that they've got left, and they're going to have to take a 25% pay cut. I mean, that's the word that's out. In fact, there was supposed to be a staff meeting yesterday to indicate who would get the pink slips, but I guess it's been moved to, I don't know, Monday or Tuesday, because they're still hoping to get some kind of money to keep their head above the water. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Scott wasn't there because they were in a crisis mode, and he was getting ready for a board meeting there Wednesday night.
Yeah, and also, Mr. Edwards, he wasn't there because there was a series of emails sent back and forth behind the scenes that I actually initiated because I was very curious about how, you know, the Urban League, the Minneapolis Urban League, could take credit or even assume to take credit to be a part of, you know, this 150 jobs thing when, first of all, they didn't have any jobs to offer. Number two, they don't have a job program. And number three, but most actually, number three should be number one, they don't have any money. Okay, and so there is money being raised here, left and right, and all this, and we hear a number of 350,000 or 58,000.
450, actually, Don. 450 was the first number that Major King gave the group 3 weeks ago, that he and Scott Gray were going to raise $450,000 to put 150, and then they even enlarged the number 150 to 200 young African Americans. People coming out of the actual designated tornado area. Actually, they were supposed to start on the 11th of July. Were they able to meet that date? Did we have 150 African-American youth working on the streets on the 11th of July?
No, we did not.
That's right.
And one thing, Mr. Edwards, that they're not telling anybody, or, you know, if you're informed, you know this stuff, and you just kind of sit back and give a little chuckle. I mean, it's unfortunate for the children. Because, you know, Mr. Edwards, here in the Twin Cities, you know, growing up, being a born and raised native of the Twin Cities here, for all my life, I know that the day that I got out of school, June 6th, I started work June 7th.
Okay? Yeah.
And I worked from June 7th to August 22nd, or the last, like, right in August, because school started September 3rd. So they gave me a week off to rest, and I always took those jobs where I was mowing lawns and stuff like that. So you needed that week to, like, calm down.
Okay.
But I had a pocket full of money. The unfortunate thing about this is that, again, the job program ends August 22nd. So
yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah, these kids are working less than a little bit over a month. They have to wait a week before they get their first paycheck, and they wait a week before they get their last paycheck. That's just how the system is set up.
Okay.
And it's a shame that no one had the foresight to make sure that this thing was implemented the day after they got out of school in June, so it can benefit them, because the tornado happened in May, okay? 22nd of May, and so they had all this time to implement all this stuff. And
well, but here's the focus that you're losing, Don. They were proficient in the areas that they needed to be proficient in the interest of corruption, because, Don, you and I know, we broke the story, that by the 1st of June, a little over a week after the tornado, they received $206,000
yes.
for Urban Homeworks, the minority contractors, Thor specifically, because the minority contractors really weren't let in on it unless they had, you know, kind of signed their life away. So within a week and a quarter after the tornado, there were excellent plans in place, and that had brought about $206,000, which, by the way, no one can explain what happened to that money. And we've asked the question, I've asked the question in my columns and on my blog, who was the fiscal agent? Because allegedly at that point, the Minneapolis Foundation, and by the way, our good friend Gary Ryerson is stepping down within a year. After three decades or thereabouts as the president, executive director, and et cetera. So, you know, Don, you and I sat in probably 8 or 9 or 10 meetings, and we would periodically ask the question, when were we going to get a report from Urban Homeworks and whoever? See, you know the one committee that we – well, two committees, actually, that we were supposed to have and we didn't have? One was the audit committee, right?
Yeah.
And the other one was the construction committee, because, as you know, Mr. Allen, we uncovered the fact that on June 3rd, 2011, the Minneapolis Foundation and the United Way announced that the committee we had been sitting on since day one, had received $206,000, right, to remodel and refurbish 30 to 50 homes, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We received that documentation, all right? That document is in my hands. Okay, and so when they want to do something with accelerated speed and et cetera, they can do it. But if it's for the victims, if you will, doesn't happen. Say we need to give that phone number, Don.
Sure.
Some people have been saying we don't give that enough. They'd like to try to call in. Let's give that number.
Yeah, our call-in number, toll-free call-in number is 877-572-4288. Again, toll-free number is 877-572-4288. You're listening to On Point on Blog Talk Radio, and I'd just like to throw in there also, Mr. Edwards, that we are consistently upgrading our systems and testing out new technology, and this show is actually being broadcast live at McIntosh Studios, downtown Minneapolis, on the Apple iPad.
Okay,
so
all right.
That should set people back a little.
Okay. Now, I understand. Well, I don't understand. I mean, I'm only saying that for journalistic purposes. The committee has now moved into the area of mental health behavioral conduct and et cetera, and a nice a piece of money has been received. There's some nice pharmaceutical money out there that's in play. And here's the thing that troubles me on that, Don. A lot of people on the committee probably don't realize that the actual structure was actually set out and directed and dictated by the mayor and others in a communique sent to the website of a specific individual of the core group on, I want people to listen close now, on the 25th day of May at approximately 3 p.m., the committee structure was, in fact, authorized and ordered to be implemented. And interesting enough, on the 25th of May, when this document, the organizational chart, actually was signed off on by Powers Downtown, there wasn't a mental health and chemical committee, because initially the decision had been made that they didn't know if they were going to be able to move. But after the incident at North High School, where allegations were made that a number of African Americans victims stood up and raised questions about the money, if you will, it was decided this was the time to move the Cicchetti agenda, the Cicchetti plan. Dr. Dante Cicchetti, eminent psychiatrist, psychologist, et cetera. So we now are in the business of dealing with mental health, okay? What is your thinking on that, and can we remember when there was really any meaningful discussion in the committee?
I think that there's two things there. Whenever there's a disaster, and thank you. I hate you for starting to act up because it stopped raining and the sun came out. So whenever there's a disaster in the black community, at some levels there is a all call put out for mental health, which means that, you know, these people are going to be angry. They're going to ask questions. They're going to want to know where the money is. They're going to storm City Hall. We need to keep them as far away from City Hall as possible. We need to keep them out of the face of elected officials. And if you notice,
so in other words, stop them from coming to the convention center as they did in the first 7 or 8 days.
Yes, exactly.
When they had the we don't want these Negroes downtown.
Yeah, we don't
come on now.
We don't want, you know, those people around us, and the people who are saying that in the most cases are people that look just like us. And so
they are.
Yeah, and so with that said, you know, this mental illness thing clicks on. So it's unfortunate, because if you are poor and you don't have the wherewithal to get a job and you need county help, you will be routed through this mental health process. I've seen it happening already. There was, Mr. Edwards, there was a friend of mine who had a younger brother who just – seemed after the tornado, could not do the right thing. And he ended up, they said, okay, we're not going to charge you with anything, but the Hennepin County Mental, like psychiatric court, where he's required to go once every 2 weeks and meet with a psychiatrist, meet with a caseworker, and meet with social service person. You know, there's two different people there to make sure that all his human needs are being met, if his rent is being paid, and just stuff like that. And so this guy is indefinitely locked into the system because he doesn't have the wherewithal to do anything else. And because, you know, after tornado, you know, they look at him and says, okay, you know, you probably don't need to go to jail, but you might be a little bit crazy, so we're going to mark you as schizophrenic, bipolar, mania.
The drugs are in my column in the Spokesman Recorder this week. I identify the drugs that have been authorized to be used on black Americans, and particularly children and you know, seniors. I guess we're going to get rid of our seniors as quickly as we can, too.
Yeah. So, you know, they'll be putting out the Zoloft, the amitriptyline, the Wellbutrin, you know, and and all the other neuroreceptor type drugs. And one thing that they're doing this year was that listeners should know also is that you need to Google the reptile brain. If you Google the reptile brain, you'll get a diagram. And actually, I'm going to put a link to that up in the chat room.
Sure.
You will get
a lot of hits on that.
Yeah, you will plenty. You will get a diagram of what it is that I'm talking about and why
right.
look at this and they say, wow, this is very interesting. And maybe that, you know, this controls these folks' flight or fright, love, hate. It's just a variety of stuff. And it falls right into, you know, you have the neocortex, you have limbus, and then you have like the brainstem and back where all your, the reptilian brain, actually, they call it.
Right.
That controls a lot of these items. And again, you have a community of, again, I got to say this, I got to stress this to folks because I'm not, you know, you have a community of poor people that are at subject to be dissected, studied, researched, and against their will, but they don't have any other choice because the other option is either jail, homelessness, suspension of services. You know, we're not going to say give you $250 of food stamps, and but that's just the way the system is working right now. And there's already plenty of examples, Mr. Edwards, out there of people that are caught in this situation.
Uh-huh.
And I am now posting a link on the chat room so people can check that out because it's a real scary subject. And you know, the city, I think. Actually, from the state, there's $200,000 sitting there to do the mental health piece in North Minneapolis.
And behavioral, which raises a serious question. I mean, this was a natural disaster. Why all of a sudden are you concerned about people's behavioral circumstances other than the whole issue of the fact of dealing with so-called violent black youth? But go ahead.
Yeah, and so with that said... we also have to look at the other piece of this, Mr. Edwards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Again, you have another chunk of change not directly routed to victims, but routed to agencies to continue the work of the agencies in bypassing the actual human needs of individuals.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. We're going to get this cattle call done. We're going to get these people in order. We're going to study them, and we're going to list off the number of people we studied, the suggestions we made, what we found. I mean, it's going to be a brilliant report for academia, you know, people that are in the universities and study this. I mean, they're going to get
well,
a great
actually, Don, they've already done that. That was what reported on a year ago, the presentation by the mayor to the National League of Cities and the Institute for Children and Parents. They've actually, the reports are already in place. That's the reason they were able to move so quickly as it pertains to UROC's role and the beginning of the training and et cetera. I mean, the plan is already in place, been in place as long as far back as 1972, the Lindsay Arthur plan, the Cicchetti plan that he operated at the Mount New Hope clinics in Rochester, New York, and the Bronx, New York. And so the plan is in place, it's happening, and that's another piece of money for, quote-unquote, the so-called Northside recovery team, if you will. So this is going to be lucrative, if you will. It kind of makes you wonder just how many African-Americans are going to be left in another couple of years. But anyways, back to the jobs, because that's really what's on, because we've been hearing so much. I heard a spokesperson on the air Thursday for radio station KMOJ, who was, you know, received money, saying that 150 youth were at work, and that's really not true. And I know she was sitting there when, in fact, the head of Emerge spoke after one of his representatives had spoke earlier. And they said the next 80, they said 70 were already at work. It started, and they can't quite get the dates right, either Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, even though they were initially supposed to start on the 11th. But he said 70. He said the other 80 wouldn't be able to start until around the 1st of August. And based on the date you gave just a couple minutes ago, that means at best you'll have about 12 days to work, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, what, 22 days? Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, so... I wonder why a journalist would say 150 African Americans are at work when everybody knows that's really not true. And Now, by the way, did Emerge and them get a list that represented the criteria, and that was the criteria to hire and give preference hiring to those that resided directly in the tornado zone? Because when Emerge put together their list way back in January and February, there hadn't been a tornado. So are people doing cross-listing, cross-referencing, or what the heck is happening here?
No, here's what the deal is. Here's what people have to understand, Mr. Edwards. People can say that these jobs are for the people in tornado zone.
Okay.
A person from Duluth, Minnesota could come down here tomorrow, and they cannot deny him an application to fill out.
Right.
Somebody from
right.
St. Paul could come and apply for a job, and they cannot deny that individual's application. There are very strict EOE laws in the state of Minnesota. Very strict. And you can't, this would be just like the Laurier Avenue Bridge and the drop down where in the paperwork through Summit Academy OIC that, and I'm paraphrasing here, and that said that, you know, graduates or the students from the Summit Academy OIC would kind of be given exclusivity on working on this project. Well, you see that it never happened because the project went on, but that's against the law. That's a violation of federal, state, local, every law there is out there as far as it pertains to unemployment. So you cannot pigeonhole a group of, that takes an act of, a huge act, maybe even an act of Congress, just to say, hey, you're only going to hire the people right here, right now, in this area, period. Doesn't work like that.
Well, is that the reason that the negotiations apparently broke down with the city of Minneapolis and the Public Works Department? Because, again, I take us all the way back to the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th of July when people were being told that 150 to 200 African-American youth 14 to 21 would be hired working on Minneapolis of public works projects. Now I'm hearing that it's supposed to be park board projects, but the fact of the matter is someone said they saw on a website here, it may have been the Minneapolis Mirror website, that held the park board only had 16 positions open, and they had to give preferential consideration to those youth that had signed up for park board sponsored programs way back again in January and February. So do you think, could we, for the purpose of transparency, you think the transparency team could publish the list of the African Americans who are now working?
Well, you know, first of all,
is that reasonable or is that unreasonable?
That's reasonable, but first of all, the transparency team would have to learn how to spell and add and subtract. And that's funny that you should go into that because I was concerned. People going into the room, and there's another a community elder, Mr. Edwards, that I talk to quite a bit. We'll leave him my name, but he always tells me that you have people going into the room that do things well that don't need to be done, but they don't have the intellectual property of a bed bug, and they don't understand why they're in the room. And if you notice throughout this this process, the people that are being attacked, myself, you, Terry Azagary from Minneapolis Mira, we're being accused of tearing down the community. We're being accused of stopping funding. We're being accused of just all kinds of stuff that is untrue. So, Mr. Edwards, I get a phone call and I said, I'm going to record this. I'd like to play this right now for you.
Go ahead.
Top of the hour. This is the vice chair of the Transportation and Accountability Committee, Mr. Al Flowers.
Oh, okay.
PM Central Time.
Hey, let me say something. Ain't nobody doing shit illegal but y'all. And you said you're trying to figure out that they not to be with anybody. I get ready to. And you hard to be destructive. Everything you do, it doesn't, you're not trying to help.
Okay, that was let me turn that off. That was
Alfred Flowers, the chairman of the powerful NAACP's community, political action team. I noticed you referred to it as the community action. The committee is actually the political action committee. That's Alfred Flowers? That sounded like a threat.
Yeah, well, it actually is. And it's really funny that, you know, you get these stupid calls and, you know, if they don't call the Star Tribune, when the Star Tribune lit them up about that list, you know, they don't call. But you ask them where they're all over you. They, we're not doing anything wrong. But I remember a conversation that when Lissa Jones, the chair of the powerful Northside Community Response Team, Accountability and Transparency Team, Task Force, said that when they pushed Bruce Bork in the Council of Churches as a fiscal agent, you know, I remember it clearly, that meeting of Mr. Flowers and Lisa Jones actually celebrating, and Mr. Flowers said, we all will get paid, was his comment. And that's actually blood money. I mean, do you really want to accept money? But then again, the money is not going to the victims. I mean, I have yet to see, what would be really nice would be see that if any dollar,
I thought you were getting a text there. Go ahead.
No, I was looking at something. It says, sounds like y'all got legal alien problems. Just wrote that on the chat.
Ooh, somebody text you a message there with that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty good. But the thing is, you have to, I don't know how I would have done it different, Mr. Edwards, but I don't work in a nonprofit area. I just know that from my perspective, that the process is tainted. The people at the table, Scott Gray cannot raise any money. He knows no one here. No one has, he has not earned, paid his dues, as they say in white corporate America, you know? Okay. And so getting, and I'm kind of jumping around here, but the job thing, you know, there was not a solid foundation to begin with. Okay. There were no extra jobs. And that I look forward to seeing who was hired. I look forward to the reports, because that's all we'll have is reports. Unless we run into some work or might not have worked that is willing to talk about it. But,
well,
you know,
now Flowers said in the meeting Wednesday that the previous morning, which would have been Tuesday, that he had gone to Harrison Park in North Minneapolis, there just along Olson Highway, and that he had met and talked with young men who were working as a part of the new Tornado Task Force. Now, I talked to someone else who was telling me that when the question was posed to Emerge and their representatives, they could not identify where the youngsters were working. And I'm told something peculiar, and I observed it with a monitoring team under my control. We were watching people changing T-shirts. Why do you do that, Don? Kids were being told to put on different kinds of T-shirts.
Yeah.
And the reason is that the T-shirts they had on said, you know, Emerge and et cetera, and they were being asked to put on T-shirts that said Tornado Work Crew. That's the reason I asked the question. I mean, where did the actual list come from? When did these youngsters sign up? How were they actually selected? Who was the selection employment committee? Was it Thor? You know, was it the Minority Contractors? Was it Tim Campbell of the Minority Contractors? I mean, see, that's the question we haven't asked, because we've been told that that question is a question out of the weeds or an ambush. But let's talk about this for just a quick period of time. We have basically 19 minutes left, or even a little bit more. Do you realize we never had anybody really say to us back on the 17th, 18th, 19th of June, moving into the week of the fourth holidays, you notice that no one ever said, this is where a young person can come and sign up. Do you remember any declaration? I know that much later, after we raised questions about where are really the jobs, that's when we started hearing emerge. But I was in the meeting when Scott Gray of the powerful Urban League of Minneapolis said that they had youngsters signing up, and they already had a list. Now, I'm not going to reveal the negotiations, but Scott Gray, I'm told, tried to acquire or even purchase a list from a for-profit entity. I mean, you know. Have you heard anything along those similar lines?
Yes, and like I told you, Mr. Edwards, there was a barrage of emails sent out. The emails involved a couple of non-profit point people, and they were ugly because it was a direct it was after Scott Gray attempted a character assassination on me last week that I decided to start this barrage of emails to different folks. Just say, hey, okay, we need to know where this guy is and what he's doing, okay? If the Urban League is going to lose this kind of – the Urban League used to have a lot more power to the point where Pillsbury United Communities would have never got the lead on tornado and disaster relief. That would have been routed directly through the Minneapolis Urban League. And the Urban League would have then trickled down to the Pillsbury United Communities and the other folks. But, hey, Ms. Harris, we have a call coming in. Let's get that call.
Let's make it. Okay.
You're live on point. Who are we speaking with?
Oh, yeah, this is Mike.
Oh. Hey, Mike, how are you, sir?
What's going on, Chattanooga? Good. Mike, what's happening, man? What's your question?
Yeah, well, word on the street is that Mr. King has put fear into all the media people, all the bloggers. Is that true?
Did you say put fear?
Put fear?
Yeah.
Oh, no. It's more like folly. I mean, yeah, you don't want to get tied up in court, but, you know, when you're I'm kind of a Republican and a constitutionalist, so I look at the Constitution regardless of if it was written when it was written. My people were property, but it still applies today. So,
well, I can say, sir, and Mr. Allen has spoken for himself. Let me just speak over here as a blogger from Studio A. There's no fear that I have as it pertains to my right to exercise First Amendment. But I do have a fear based on the threatening message left by Mr. Flowers, threatening Mr. Allen, because I'm aware that there was an attempt to assault Mr. Allen, if you will, which ultimately was reviewed by the courts. But because it was considered black on black, it wasn't relevant. But I know that there's been discussions about doing something to people. I know that the representative of the Minneapolis Mirror newspaper really was told, even in the meeting in the presence of the funding sources and et cetera, that she very well could be the recipient of, you know, big, burly men coming in and, you know, taking her out of the building. I mean, and with Mr. Flowers talking like he's talking and given his history and reputation, I mean, there's a possibility that you could have an accident. I mean, you know, here's what I say in closing, sir. Mike, it is, right? You know, I looked at what happened at the whistleblower in England, Mr. Hoard, who clearly was murdered. And, you know, I watched the British authorities cover that up in the last 8 or 9 days. And so, I mean, what's basically filtering out of the confines of the core group is that, you know, an accident can happen. So, you know, a word to the wise kind of thing. So that would be a concern, but as far as fear, no. Because, you know, one can get what one needs a whole lot of places. You know, Major King and them are not the only ones that can and have access to the necessary items of protection. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I understand. I got word that Mr. McAfee and Mr. Moss came in there with their workout clothes on, ready to get down to business, I heard.
You know, they were there. I can't speak to what the reason was, other than Jerry McAfee announced that he had made his donation. His donation originally was identified 3 weeks before as $5,000. He said he had made his donation all of but $500, and he would be getting that back to the group because he was involved in a week-long revival. I don't know, you know, what the presence means. I'd prefer not to speak to that. You know, everybody has a right to come in. particularly if Mr. King decides, or Major King, I'm sorry, Major King decides that you are part of his side of the aisle. So anything else, Mike?
Well, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you, Mike. All right.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, see, I had heard that, Mr. Allen, that at the conclusion of activities on Wednesday and in consultation, and that there was much glee. There was actually even hand slapping and et cetera. There were certain derogatory terms made about particularly the journalist from the Minneapolis Mirror and actually yourself also, about people being, you know, put in their place. References, MF was used as kind of consistent to the tone that you just played for us, and I think it was important for the purpose of transparency that people had a chance to hear Flowers' comments and threat against your franchise, if you will, because that'd be consistent of, unfortunately, what happened out in the parking lot. So, hey, it's clear. I mean, I've had sources, operatives come to me and said that, you know, the discussion's going on is that we're not going to let them EMFs get in the middle of our money.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying? And they have powerful friends at court because there are some of them that have worked closely with the police, if you will.
Yeah.
And particularly police who don't specifically like the people that they don't like, if you will. I know that over the years that the central figures has used a member of their family to pass information back to the police. I saw this during the days of the powerful Police Community Relations Committee. So I know that what I'm hearing from reliable sources, you know, all this comes on the heels of a tragic event which a lot of people have kind of forgotten about because of the tornado, but it's going to come to trial, and that is the tragic death and assassination of Christopher Miller, which we took the forefront. In fact, it was the person that we kind of talked about who maintained that both you and I were liars, if you will, and something needed to happen to us.
Yeah.
So that person was directly involved in obstruction of a witness in that tragic assassination / murder. So, I mean, if you want to open, you know, this is back to the other side. If you want to open Pandora's box, we can open it up.
Oh, yeah. We have enough to ride on based on fact-based information that we could start a whole new campaign out there just putting out the facts and wreck police records, basically.
Yes, sir. So if you want to do that, if that's what, you know, whoever, you know, Mike is, mm-hmm. you know, Mike probably is like a lot of people hearing the whooping and the boasting that's going on, if you will. But I'll tell you this, it's certainly clear that at least two of you, according to what you're saying, did not bend nor break. And that was is that you didn't take down those postings of all that activity. And I understand that the Minneapolis Mirror has thousands of pictures and probably close to 100 hours of some real interesting and spicy conversations in those meetings going back to around the 12th, 13th of the 8th of June and et cetera. So, I mean, just kind of a response to what Mike said about fear and et cetera. I mean, you know, nobody's scared of no fear. But one understands how some people work when, you know, they tell you we're not going to allow you to cut into our hustle.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
So give that number out one more time, if you would, on your end, Mr. Allen.
Sure. The toll-free number to call in. Talk to us on point is 877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. We have about a little bit under 15 minutes remaining of the show, and we sure would like to hear from you, your thoughts, opinions, suggestions, and we love being challenged. And Mr. Edwards, just real quick here, not to totally go off track here because we're still going to stay on topic, but thing I happen to be online, and as usual, and I am reading these different stories. So I Googled the word civil rights, and lo and behold, a great story came up by a woman in Washington, D.C. Her name is Faye Anderson. Okay. She wrote the story, Why No Black Female Civil Rights Leaders.
Okay.
It's a very powerful piece, and she went as far as to give me permission to republish it on the Independent Business News Network, which is what I've done.
Sure,
so,
sure.
So if you want to see it there, it's a really powerful piece, and I also have an editor's note there that, you know, I say, you know, for 50 years, men have been at the forefront of civil rights movement, and for 50 years, guys have not cut the mustard as it pertains to addressing.
Well, let me just say this, as a longtime veteran of the civil rights struggle, going back to 1959, with the death a year ago of the beloved Dorothy Height, as an example, really that guard that really started, let's say, in modern times with the legendary Marion McLeod Bethune, Nellie Stone Johnson here out of our own Minnesota, if you will, the Fannie Lou Hammers, if you will, Shirley Chisholm, if you will. Basically, I maintain that the probably presiding African-American civil rights female who has a platform is the beloved Maxine Waters, Democratic Congresswoman out of Central L.A. You know, I'm troubled by that. I think that it's a fair piece, if you will. I look around us here in the Twin Cities, particularly during these very troubling times with the collapse and demise of our institutions in the African-American community. And I just don't see kind of person with the kind of character that would represent some of those that have passed this way. Here in Minnesota, the standard will always be Nellie Stone Johnson, if you will. They can talk about her like they want, but the fact of the matter is her history was an open book, a daughter of Minnesota, if you will, born and raised here. Down there in Dakota County, just outside of a township called Lakeville, you know, which is a municipality now. So I think that that's a very fair question. Maybe one of the ladies can give us a call and make us understand what's happening, what their thinking is. I do know that within the Black Ecumenical community, leadership there have maintained that there is no place in the ministry for black females, and people apparently have declined to debate that issue. I repeat that again. I know the leadership of the powerful black ecumenical institutions have in fact froze out African-American women, if you will.
Yes.
These same people will go to the churches, these beautiful black women, and they will give their money. They will volunteer their hard and blessed time and commitment, if you will. But there are ecumenical leadership here in Minnesota and the Twin Cities who maintain that there is no appropriate place for the African-American female. Now, I didn't know that Jesus Christ had ordained that, you know what I mean? But apparently we're talking about black ministers who rise above the word of Jesus Christ, if you will. And so, you know, it's something nobody wants to talk about. It's another one of those elephants in the room. So, you know, yeah, repost it, man.
Take a look at it. I certainly did, and we have a call. They've been on hold for about 3 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I always inform us. Give us a signal here. Okay. You got him? Hello? Hello? Yeah, you cut me off, Don. Yeah, I told you it was going to happen with that. That's why I'm not in favor of that. Okay, a little bug. Yeah, all right. Bum, 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 bum. Hello?
Oh, sorry about that. For those of you that were listening to On Point with myself, Don Allen, and Mr. Ron Edwards.
All right, we're back on. Was we have
yes.
some technical problems there, Mr. Allen?
Yes, Skype. Actually, I said we were broadcasting from the iPad, but I also had the computer backup on, and I actually got a telephone call saying that Skype was full, and it dumped our call. So, yeah, we're back on live again, Mr. Edwards, and we do have a caller again.
Go ahead. Let's get the call,
yeah? Yeah.
Live on the air.
Hi, this is Mustafa calling from Minneapolis.
Hey, Mustafa.
Yeah, Mustafa, what can I do for you? What's your question?
Yeah, I just, I was listening for a while, and sorry about the phone. There may be some technical difficulties. But I was listening. You were talking about the civil rights and, you know, how it people were, fought before and what the situation now. And I just want to say that, you know, as our immigrant community can learn a lot from that and benefit from it. I also wanted to share you the situation in the Horn of Africa, especially Somalia and Kenya and Ethiopia, that area.
The famine,
people are having trouble there trying to survive. And it's the same thing, you know. I think I said before this, but it's the same thing, you know. There you have all these non-governmental organizations who their number one goal is to exploit, and they live in expensive five-star hotels in Nairobi, Kenya, places like that, and they fly by charter, and maybe 80% of whatever money that they get, they claim to be giving those people who need to be helped in terms of, it goes back to them, basically. So, that's one thing that I want to share with you, because there's commonality. It's not something isolated in the African American community. It goes
right.
on in even African community, and it goes on in Africa. That's what I was trying to say.
All right.
Right. By the way, right. Just in fairness and transparency, I understand that the Somali Famine Relief Committee is having some fundraisers in the Twin Cities. Are those valid and legitimate?
I hope they are. I hope they are. But the history tells us a little bit different. You know, I don't want to say, you know, anybody who want to give to money to them so they can help somebody who needs to be helped. I don't want to, you know, say that don't give them. But the history tells us. I'm talking about in general.
Okay.
Because even everybody who been in that area knows, you know, they deal with the world lawyers, you know, they deliver the shipment they used to deliver to the world lawyers, and that's common, everybody knows. And I think it's kind of intentional, because it's not something that's sacred, you know.
All right. Mustafa, I want to thank you. We're down to the last 4 minutes here on our program. I want to thank you. Hope to hear from you next week.
Thank you, sir.
All
you.
Right.
Hey,
yeah.
Mr. Edwards.
Yeah.
I just got a text in the chat room, and I want to make something absolutely clear. And it's regarding Lissa Jones. My personal opinion, Lissa Jones is not a civil rights activist. She is an entertainer on the air. And I say that because she's had opportunities to stand up for the rights of African-American people or people of color in the Twin Cities, as far as the Minneapolis Public Schools Community Benefit Agreement, over $1 million in tobacco money that you know, we don't know where it is at today because we asked the question, where is the money? It was on the Council of Black Minnesota, Minnesota Council, or the Black Council.
The Council, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
Council of Black Minnesota. Mm-hmm.
And you've never heard one position from that group in 20 years on anything. They're not even at the table on the tornado relief. Okay.
Yeah, I know.
With that said, the person that left me that message, you know, it's not yet. She does come off strong, you know, soul sister. But, you know, let's leave the penitentiary tricks in the penitentiary. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's keep it real.
Because there are a lot of things going on in the village, including people saying that they're not going to do this when, in fact, they've done this and are in discussions and then didn't get their money. You know,
yeah.
a lot of heat over there at KMOJ about the fact that two people were supposed to get $1,500 under the table for allegedly helping to get the money that came to the Tornado Relief Committee.
Yeah, oh yeah, they should have lifted their hands out. You know, a sellout is a sellout is a sellout. I don't care how strong they are on civil rights on the air, but you know, you gotta talk the talk and walk the walk, and it's not happening. And that's my personal opinion.
Okay, couple things. We reached down to close. Normally, you asked me tomorrow's program, Black Focus on Channel 17. We are talking about again the tornado situation. We're also talking about what is becoming a serious controversy, and that is the firing of Marvin Corky Taylor. The role of Velma Corvell, Johnny Burns, and other important individuals. I understand that there is some examination going on with respect to some loans involving another associate director of the Civil Rights Department, Kip Brown. We talk about that on Sunday's program. We take a look at the Chiquetti Project on the move and how African-American mothers and their babies have been identified for clinical and diagnostic programs and et cetera. So, you know, certainly tune in on that. And tomorrow on the Black Focus Blog Radio, 3 o'clock, we're going to be following up with some of the things that me and Mr. Allen have been talking about here, some additional background on Corky Taylor and how there is a significant move to cover up $1.4 million that Urban Homeworks is receiving. Oops. And you remember, Don, you were sitting there when they gave the housing report. They keep forgetting to mention that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They don't say a darn blast of thing about that, Mr. Edwards.
No. And by the way, in Wednesday's edition of our column in the paper, we identify five properties that Urban Homeworks is working on, none of which I believe will be available to African-American tornado victims.
Mm. Not good. Well,
certainly our concerns for African-Americans along the 2100 block of Russell Avenue North in Minneapolis in the Fifth Ward who have been receiving letters of significant intimidation. They have had imposed upon them a specific provision dealing with nuisance, which is almost a non-appealable citation. If you do not clean up the nuisance, if you will, you will be faced with eviction. And these are private homeowners, okay? So that's what we're rolling in with over the next couple of days.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank everybody for listening, and we'll be back next week at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time. You've been listening to On Point with Ronald A. Edwards and Don Allen. Thank you.
Thank you.